From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. He's a two-horned, two-faced, spotlight-hogging, flip-flopping, passing purple people-eater. Ahead on Only a Game, against our better judgment, we violate our self-imposed no-farv zone. Also, heat-related football deaths continue 8 years after the death of Vikings lineman Corey Stringer, and moths flutter to the Columbia River Valley to race on the water. Also ahead, how sports fundraisers have raised revenues for charities across the country.
Once they see that you're willing to do something that maybe you've never done or something to go beyond your boundaries, hopefully it will inspire them to maybe take a few more dollars out of their pockets or their checkbook and send it our way.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, in for Bill Littlefield, who's on a soccer pilgrimage to the Home Depot Center. During the NFL preseason, stars only play a quarter or two, and fans don't put much stock in the game's final outcomes. It's often a quiet time for the league, except when it isn't. Joining me now to talk about the storylines for the upcoming NFL season is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Obviously, Brett Favre felt like he didn't get enough attention last year when he came out of retirement to play for the Jets. Now he's at it again, this time with the Green Bay Packers' divisional rival, Minnesota. Are the Vikings making the right move?
Brett Favre had a good start to the season with the Jets, but as a then 38, now 39-year-old signal caller, he faded down the stretch. The Jets fell apart, and the season was basically a disaster. I think the real issue is how does he command the locker room with the Vikings, because he's told these guys he didn't want to go there twice now. One thing about training camp, one of the benefits, not just in getting sharp for the season, is the camaraderie from the difficult challenges physically, and so he's now skipped out on that. The other two guys, Sage Rosenfeld and Tavares Jackson, were there for every single workout, and obviously they're going to have friends on that team. So it's a real roll of the dice for Minnesota, which is a team that won 10 games and made the playoffs last year. But you need great chemistry to win in the NFL. It's not just talent.
Cincinnati Bengals wideout Chad Ochocinco, formerly Chad Johnson, is good at catching passes. It turns out his alter ego, Esteban Ochocinco, is good at kicking. He made an extra point in a win over New England Thursday. If he kicks again, do you think the NFL will let him have two jerseys, one for Chad and one for Esteban?
I think he'll stick with one, because 85 is his number, which, and he, of course, is renamed himself legally Ochocinco, Spanish for 8 and 5, but not 85. This was a good thing, though, for Chad, because he loves attention. And it was a pretty good boot, I got to say. So he may have a secondary career when the speed leaves him as a receiver. His big thing was he didn't have a great season last year. A lot of hype about the guy, a lot of touchdown celebrations. He needs more touchdowns, though.
Former New York Giants wide receiver Plaxico Burress pled guilty to a weapons charge and will be sentenced next month to 2 years in prison. Burress accidentally shot himself in the leg in a New York nightclub in November. This has to rank pretty high on the stupidest crimes by an athlete list, right?
Well, first let's consider who he shot. He shot himself. You'd think that shooting yourself in the leg and losing the rest of the season would be punishment enough. I mean, this is, talk about your victimless crime. Man, he tries to fight the charges, and what he really should have done is just pled guilty immediately. Biggest problem is he waited 9-10 months after, when he could have been sitting in prison. Now he's not going to be back with any chance until, at best, the 2011 season.
Philadelphia decided to take the plunge and signed Michael Vick. Is this what the Eagles need to bring home a Super Bowl victory?
This is the crime and punishment edition of the
Only
Game.
Really is.
Yeah, pros and cons in the NFL. What Michael Vick can probably do, no one really knows because he's been out of football and been in prison, but he brings sort of a game-breaking situational skill set. He can come in short yardage or goal line situations and you don't know whether he's going to run or pass. I think it was a low-risk decision, other than the protests they'll get from animal rights lovers.
The Colts beat the Eagles Thursday in Indianapolis. Peyton Manning looked sharp with 2 touchdown passes, including a 76-yarder to Reggie Wayne. Will the Colts reclaim the top spot in the AFC South from Tennessee this season?
Real X factor is the Colts. Tony Dungy, the longtime coach, is gone. He's been replaced by longtime assistant Jim Caldwell. And where that fits in, how do they handle Manning? What new wrinkles do they bring along is going to be the question here, because there's no question there's talent. The offense struggled last year. It was the offense that let them down in the playoffs. I don't think it would be a shock if they made a really deep playoff run. Not sure it would be a shock if they went 8-8 either.
The Detroit Lions visit the Browns in Cleveland tonight. Last week, the Lions won their first preseason game, and it was their first victory since their last preseason game in 2008. Is there any hope for a turnaround in Detroit this year?
If you're watching preseason football, or even worse, there's people who gamble on preseason football, please remember that the Detroit Lions went a perfect 4-0 last year in the preseason and then 0-16 in the regular season. So these games are completely meaningless. They'll be better. You can say that about the Lions.
They couldn't be worse.
No, new coach. They have a rookie quarterback who I think is going to throw for a lot of interceptions and a lot of great passes in Matthew Stafford, their number one pick. They'll win 3 or 4 games.
Dan, what teams have we missed that you're expecting to do big things this season?
I think the whole league hinges on Tom Brady and his knee up in New England. I mean, this team was 18-0 going into the Super Bowl. They come back the next year, Brady gets hurt in the first quarter, and they still put together an 11-5 season. Brady's back. They actually have more receivers now than they did in the 2008 season. So if this team is cooking, this is a 13-14 win team. This is the team to beat if Tom Brady is healthy. And, you know, it's funny, the team absolutely nobody talks about in the preseason is the Pittsburgh Steelers, who, by the way, won the Super Bowl last year. Look out, they're always really good.
Dan Wetzel covers the NFL for Yahoo Sports and joins us regularly on Only a Game. Dan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Looking forward to a wild season, as always.
Minnesota Vikings offensive lineman Corey Stringer died on a practice field in 2001, calling attention to the dangers of training during hot summer weather. 8 years later, there are still unresolved legal issues surrounding his death, and the sport is coming off one of its deadliest years in history. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
For many fans, football is a rite of fall that goes hand in hand with the new school year and the changing colors of the foliage. But for players and coaches, the real work begins with training camps and double session practices in sometimes sweltering summer weather. During the 2008 football season, 4 high school and 2 college players died of heat stroke. That's the highest number of heat stroke deaths since 7 players died in 1972. Frederick Mueller is the director of the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research, which is based at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The American Football Coaches Association tracks football-related deaths. Mueller co-authors that annual survey.
Since 1995, there's been the increase in the number of heat stroke deaths. There have been 39 total through 2008. 29 of those are at the high school level, and since 95, it's been a real concern.
There have been 125 heat stroke deaths since the data was first recorded in 1931. Perhaps the most widely reported of them happened on July 31, 2001, when Vikings offensive lineman Corey Stringer collapsed during the second day of training camp in Mankato, Minnesota. The heat index, which combines temperature and humidity, reached 110 on the field that day. The 335-pound tackle was coming off his first All-Pro season. He died the next day. The 27-year-old is the only player in NFL history to die of heat stroke. Jimmy Gould was Stringer's agent and now serves as spokesman for the Stringer family. Gould says players need to be educated about the risks so they'll be more comfortable admitting when they're not feeling well.
No one's going to challenge what a coach or a trainer or anybody is going to tell them. I mean, they're there to take the orders and go and deliver the blows and do what they got to do. That's the sport.
In 2003, Stringer's widow settled with one of the doctors who treated her husband. Earlier this year, Kelsey Stringer and the NFL also agreed to a settlement, which includes plans for a league-sponsored program to educate amateur and professional coaches and players about the dangers of heat illness. Kelsey Stringer is also suing Riddell, the maker of the helmet and shoulder pads Corey Stringer wore at training camp. The lawsuit alleges Riddell had an obligation to put warnings about heat stroke on the equipment. Riddell turned down Only a Game's requests for an interview. Via email, a spokesman wrote, quote, "As we intend to aggressively defend our products at trial, it would be inappropriate to comment on the facts and issues involved prior to trial," unquote. Stringer family spokesman Jimmy Gould says he believes warnings could have made a difference.
By having the warning, you're telling somebody this may have been the way it was back when, but there's just too many people going down right now.
As Riddell and the Stringers prepare for a jury trial in U.S. District Court in November, a criminal trial involving another football death is set to begin on August 31st in Kentucky. 15-year-old Max Gilpin collapsed during practice in Louisville last August and died 3 days later. According to the Jefferson County Coroner's Office, the sophomore's body temperature was 107 degrees. His coach, David Jason Stinson, is charged with reckless homicide and may also face a charge of first-degree wanton endangerment. The maximum sentence for each is 5 years in prison. Gilpin's parents have also filed a civil suit against Stinson and other school employees. Frederick Mueller says in nearly 3 decades of tracking football deaths, this is the first time he's heard of a coach facing criminal charges after a heatstroke incident. Mueller's 2009 report is unequivocal about football's heat-related deaths. Quote, "There is no excuse for any number of heatstroke deaths since they are all preventable with the proper precautions," unquote. Mueller says there are several steps teams need to take to protect players.
You don't know where they're coming from if they haven't been working out all summer. They may have been in the mountains in a cooler climate. You have to acclimatize the athletes to get them used to the heat. Weigh in before practice, weigh out after practice, see how much weight you've lost. Rest periods for the athletes, let them take off their helmets, cool down, let them drink cold water.
Dr. Alan Asher is the chairman of the Student Health and Sports Medicine Committee for the Massachusetts Medical Society. Asher says improper hydration is a major safety issue, and educational programs for players and coaches need to break down the perception that withholding water will make players tougher.
Some coaches feel that if you take a drink during the practice, that indicates you're less capable, and indeed that's just not true. The better you hydrate, I think the better you're going to play.
At least 3 players have died in preseason practices in 2009. On July 8th, Western Carolina University player Jaquavion Smalls died during voluntary workouts in North Carolina. On July 29th, Fort Campbell Jr. Timothy Williams became the 3rd Kentucky high school football player to die in the past 4 years after he became disoriented at practice. And last week, 16-year-old Raymond Tyndall was practicing for New Madrid County Central High School in Missouri when he collapsed and died. The final autopsy results are pending for all 3 athletes. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The Ring is billed as the longest and most challenging race course in the world. The German track is 13 miles long with 73 bends, and it's been used for Grand Prix races since the 1930s. On non-race days, anyone with a street-worthy car and a driver's license can pay to go for a drive, and track officials grudgingly admit that, quote, "petrol heads have mishaps every now and again." But one of the fastest cars on the track isn't really a car at all. It's the world's fastest fire engine. Capable of getting to even the most distant spot on the course in just 3.5 minutes, the Ring's Nissan GT-R has a tank filled with fire retardant foam where its back seats should be and a hose rolled up in the trunk. Which leaves the only question, who's the lucky firefighter who gets to drive it? I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the NFL specialist who gets paid for going entirely unnoticed. But first, It's mid-July, and in just a week and a half, the supplies stacked to the ceiling of this Needham, Massachusetts warehouse will have been distributed to 46 towns along 8 routes for the largest single-event sports fundraiser in the country. Billy Starr started the Pan Mass Challenge 30 years ago. Back then, there were no forklifts or warehouses or barcoded wristbands.
It was very modest. I mean, 1980, we had 36 riders, probably 10 volunteers. Everybody got lost. We ran out of food. The ferry didn't run. And I was ceremoniously thrown in the harbor as the alleged captain of the ship. To my way of thinking, we did everything wrong. And yet, the event was fulfilling something in there, a psychic need, a need to give back, of something that we would later call, you know, sports-oriented philanthropy.
Sure, kids have been raising a penny per free throw for decades, but setting fundraising minimums in the thousands for a sporting event that requires months of training, that was a new idea. The PMC was the first event in the country to bill participants who don't meet their fundraising goals, even if circumstances keep them from riding. So why do 5,000 people accept these terms every year? Billy Starr says riding the PMC might be charitable, but it's not selfless.
I've often said, well, you know, I'm a pretty good salesman, but ride the PMC and you'll give me anything. There is palpable energy being expended towards forwarding your success in an outdoor event, come hella high water, hail, rain, or big heat.
Riders are called clients, and Billy Starr offers them four-season service. Despite its charitable leanings, the Pan Mass Challenge is a business, part of a $3 billion industry. Dave Hesekiel, president of the Run, Walk, Ride Fundraising Council, says that industry is growing.
We've come a long way from when I was a kid, where somebody would hand you a slip of paper and say, would you give me 25 cents for every mile that I walk? The internet has become a huge tool. One can now reach out to numerous people. They can click, enter their credit card data, and suddenly they are a sponsor of yours. And that has raised the complexity of the programs, but it's also tremendously increased the opportunity.
First-time rider!
Volunteers ring a bell as Sean Garvin checks in for his first PMC. He's an anesthesiologist riding in honor of his mentor, who's being treated for cancer. As a doctor, Sean probably knows enough inspiring stories to convince his friends to give to the cause anyway. So why ride almost 200 miles to raise a few thousand dollars?
Great question, but I think it shows commitment on our part to the cause. And so once they see that you're willing to do something that maybe you've never done or something to go beyond your boundaries, hopefully it will inspire them to maybe take a few more dollars out of their pockets or their checkbook and send it our way.
Two psychologists at Princeton University studied that phenomenon. They found that a person will give 50% more money to participate in a charity 5-mile run than he will to attend a charity picnic. More significantly, donors will pledge 3 times more money to a charitable cause if the friend asking for money is also performing a task that takes considerable effort.
Thank you all for being here. Welcome to the 30th staging of the Pan Mass Challenge.
Billy Starr takes the stage for an hour-long kickoff show aired live on a local cable news channel. Mike Andrews is a former Red Sox player and chairman of the Jimmy Fund at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where 100% of rider-raised money is sent. He's one of the few who's been around for all 30 years of the PMC, and he's the last person who would have guessed that the ride would raise $270 million in its first 30 years.
I wasn't sure if he was going to get 2 dozen or 3 dozen of his friends to ride. Now, I figured, you know, they're pretty much on this thing for a joyride to boot. Now, that doesn't sound like a $50,000 event, yet alone a million dollar, and now a $35 million event. I mean, it is just the most phenomenal thing that I think has ever happened in fundraising, quite honestly.
Cherry Street Love Day! Welcome to Cherry!
To To hear the people of Cherry Street in Wrentham talk about it, the Pan Mass Challenge might be the most phenomenal thing that's happened to their street. Every year, the riders pedal through this quiet, shady neighborhood, and every year, the neighbors come out to greet them.
One, two, three!
Donna Dunn is taking her picture with two PMC riders who've gotten off their bikes for a chat. Jamie Shear started stopping here years ago when he noticed Donna's mother, Margaret McKillop, sitting under a blue awning. She had breast cancer, and Jamie started using her photo on his thank you cards.
He had stopped to see her for over 6 or 7 years, and he fell in love with her. And then when he came up over the hill last year and she wasn't here, he was heartbroken. And I had a beautiful picture for him, and he put it in his backpack, and he said, she's finally going to do the whole ride.
Jamie hands Donna a framed picture of her mom's photo set against a beautiful sunset in Provincetown. Donna shows it to her neighbors with tears in her eyes and a smile on her face.
That nice?
Yeah.
That's only one of the stories, right?
Everywhere you turn at the PMC, there's a person with a story. Under a big white tent at the 85-mile mark waits a story I've heard before. Catherine Fenollosa and I used to work together on the NPR program Car Talk. Just over 4 years ago, her son Henry was diagnosed with cancer in utero. He was delivered a month early, started on chemotherapy when he was just 27 hours old. And Catherine says if it wasn't for recent advancements in cancer treatment, he wouldn't be here today. Henry's a PMC pedal partner, which means he has a whole team riding in his honor, including the doctor who saved him and his mommy's old friend, Car Talk producer and former Only a Game senior producer, David Green.
When David sort of asked if he could ride in Henry's honor, I was so floored. It's a huge commitment for someone to undertake, and it's a lot of training and a lot of dedication and a lot of fundraising that you have to do. And for him to want to do that for Henry, I mean, what more could you ask? You know, I mean, when I was looking at the weather for this weekend, it was saying 90 degrees, and I was thinking, oh God, David.
David's fine and grinning ear to ear when he arrives to say hi to Henry. Cindy Hale practically bounces into the tent to greet her pedal partner, Jace. Cindy rides for Team Flames, which has the largest number of cancer survivors of any Pan Mass team.
The team started 9 years ago when I was a patient, and my nurses told me if I got better, they'd get on a bike and ride with me. And 9 years later, we've raised $2 million, and we all still ride.
Billy Starr likes to say that everybody gets something out of riding the PMC, and Cindy Hale seems like a good person to ask.
What do I get out of it? Save my life. I had two terrible cancers, and I got to do trial drugs thanks to money raised by Pan Mass Challenge.
And were you a cyclist before you got sick?
No. Never. I mean, never. But it's so inspiring. We have doctors on our team that they are in there saving patients' lives, and then they come out and get on a bike with us. Nurses, it's amazing.
At the day one finish line, riders swarm in by the hundreds, then the dozens, and hours later, one by one. As they get ready to bunk overnight to rest up for day two, many say they'll be riding this event until a cure is found for cancer. 8 of the 15 largest sports philanthropic events in this country benefit cancer research. So if they get their wish, there will be millions of runners, bikers, and walkers looking for a new cause for which to sweat. It's a sports story that starts in a most unlikely place, a seventh grade Bible class at a Baptist middle school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. That's where Brian Kinchin, a 38-year-old Bible teacher and former NFL player, gets the call that brings him to the New England Patriots for a late season tryout in 2003. The book is called The Long Snapper, A Second Chance, A Super Bowl, A Lesson for Life. And it's written by Jeffrey Marks, who joins me in the studio. Jeffrey, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Long snapper Brian Kinchin is here as well. Hello, Brian.
Thank you, Karen. Glad to be here.
The main job of a long snapper is to hike a football upside down and between his legs so that it can be punted or kicked in for a field goal. Brian, when you got that call from the Patriots to come up to Foxborough for a tryout, you had come to terms with your new life as a Bible teacher. But Jeffrey says you carried around with you a sense of failure over your football career. How can 13 seasons with four different teams possibly be considered a failure?
Well, it's just because of the personality that I have. My affirmation came through my performance, and I always wanted to be, growing up, a superstar in the NFL, and yeah, I was able to play for 13 years, but never really gained that stardom, I guess, that I thought I longed for, that I needed, that I wanted that approval from those that I thought mattered. I had accepted the fact that, you know, I got 13 good years, and I was very, very thankful for that, and never really ever thought about not winning a championship in the end. But obviously being called back changed that. I just think it's my personality, even to this day, in other aspects of my life as a teacher. I always try to work to get better at what I do, feeling that, you know, maybe that I'm a pretender every now and again at what I'm doing.
Brian got the job despite a rare blown snap. Jeffrey, did you get a sense as to why the Patriots chose Brian, even though he'd been out of the game for 3 years and had a less than perfect tryout?
I think there was a trust level there because Brian had played before for Coach Bill Belichick with the Cleveland Browns. Brian had actually been a tight end in the NFL as well as a long snapper. So there's no question from the research I did that it was all about relationships. Belichick knew and trusted him. Scott Pioli, the general manager, knew and trusted him, and one blown snap in the tryout didn't change any of that. He's the guy they wanted. They thought at some point the whole season might be on the line and the ball would be in one guy's hands, and they had a comfort level with Brian.
Brian, there's a particularly sweet moment when the Patriots are in the playoffs and you're feeling a little bit homesick. Your wife brings you cards and letters from the kids in your Bible class back home, and reading them gives you a greater sense of fulfillment than sports ever had. Can that really be right? Can being a teacher be more fulfilling than being a pro football player?
Oh, without question. I don't even think it's even comparable. Teaching is a wonderful occupation, obviously, but to be able to teach them about who our Creator is, who our Savior is unmatched. And obviously, what I was doing obviously contributed to their intrigue of the moment. I don't think if I would have gone off on a moving truck to go work for a week, it would have been a big deal. But it really is nice because I'm up here in New England in snow and ice and just not real comfortable and out of my element, wondering what I'm doing here. And it really did give a sense of peace about it.
Jeffrey, I'm going to ask you to describe how Brian was feeling and snapping in the weeks before Super Bowl 38, because asking Brian just seems too cruel.
Well, it might in a sense seem cruel, but Brian has been so open about it, which has been one of the really neat things as a writer and a storyteller. Brian struggled for a few weeks, especially leading up to the Super Bowl, with his snapping. He wasn't snapping well in practice. He had thrown a bad one in a game. Things got so bad that he had taken footballs back with him to the hotel and snapping them into pillows he had piled up against the wall.
The neighbors must have loved that.
The neighbors must have loved it. But he was doing anything he could because, again, that's his focus, that's his determination, that's his intensity, that's his work ethic. Things had gotten so bad the Wednesday before the Sunday Super Bowl, Brian comes back from his worst practice yet and actually goes to talk to Scott Pioli and tell him, hey, you guys need to get a new long snapper. I'm going home. I don't want to blow this for the team. You know, here we are about to win the Super Bowl. I don't want to be the GOAT and cost this group of guys that has worked so hard this ultimate goal of theirs. So, yes, it had gotten pretty rough.
I'm speaking with Jeffrey Marks, the author of The Long Snapper, and Brian Kinchin, the said long snapper. You're listening to Only a Game. Faith is a frequent topic throughout this book, and Brian, when you came down with that case of the yips before the Super Bowl, your teammate Don Davis blamed the devil for making your snaps go awry. What do you think the problem was?
Well, Don's a little extreme for me, but I shared a moment with my father right after the kick, which to me, it was so crystal clear at that point. I talked with him about Gideon of the Old Testament, where where God basically continued to take away his army to down to 300 men to where Gideon could take no claim for the victory, that it had to be God. Because I had so much confidence coming in that I never thought twice about bad snaps or anything. And in that 7-week period, stripped that confidence away from me day by day, especially in those last 2 weeks, to where I was totally depleted of any confidence that I could do my job. And ultimately, I had to go out there and throw that football. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if it weren't for God allowing it to get to where it was going, that it wouldn't have happened.
Well, if the goal of a long snapper is to go completely unnoticed, Brian must have done okay, because I watched that game and I don't remember him.
Yeah, but I'll tell you this. Had he thrown a bad one and it cost the New England Patriots the game with only 9 seconds left on the clock, everyone would remember him. They would certainly remember him in New England, and I have a feeling it would have extended even a bit further than that.
Although there's considerable tension at the end of the book, we know from the beginning that Brian will go home with a Super Bowl ring. So I don't feel like I'm spoiling the ending by asking you, Brian, how has life changed since you acquired that particular piece of jewelry?
Well, it was obviously a moment of pure ecstasy in the sense of where I was emotionally before that snap and where we ended up as world champions at the end. It was a very wonderful experience, and it's given me a perspective that most people will never have in life, and that's basically attaining the ultimate goal that you had set out for yourself in life, and to see the reality of it and how it really doesn't make that much of a difference. It's just an event. It's just an achievement that doesn't change me. It doesn't change who I am.
Brian Kinchin is a Super Bowl winning long snapper and Bible teacher at Parkview Baptist Middle School. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Karen.
And Jeffrey Marks is the author of The Long Snapper, published by Harper One. Jeffrey, thanks to you as well.
Great being here. Thank you, Karen.
A pulse pounding finish to Super Bowl 38.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Who would give the head coaching position of a national soccer team to a 25-year-old kid with no real experience? Well, if you're the Pacific Island of Pompeii and the closest you've ever come to winning a match was losing 5-4 on penalties to rival island Yap, you've got nothing else to lose. Paul Watson, a freelance sports journalist, and his buddy Matthew Conrad, who's also 25, heard about the open position by chance and offered to take over the hapless team for free. Mr. Watson says of his charges, they are really enthusiastic. Unfortunately, they are the worst team in the world, but I don't think they will be for much longer. I wonder how the folks across the water in Yap feel about that. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the International Moth World Championships. And I'm not talking about flying insects. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Charlie, I hate to start out our conversation on a bad note, but after signing with the Minnesota Vikings on Tuesday, Brett Favre is back. Can I count you among those who would rather he wasn't?
I don't care one way or the other. I stopped caring about Brett Favre a couple years ago. Double the amount I don't care about Brett Favre, and you'll have how much I don't care what Fran Tarkenton thinks about Brett Favre. I stopped caring about what Fran Tarkenton said about anything when he turned up on one of my channels in the middle of the night doing infomercials for some financial scam.
As you and Bill discussed last week, Michael Vick is also back, and the Philadelphia Eagles say none of the team's sponsors backed out of their contracts due to the signing. I bet the marketing department was happy to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how hard it is for a sponsor to back out, to be honest with you. Usually these contracts are multi-year. you know, he hasn't yet played yet. He hasn't made a trip with them yet. We shall see what the circus outside the stadium is like, but it looks like corporate America is going to embrace him, or at least not throw him out the window.
Why don't we get all the NFL police blotter stories out of the way all at once, Charlie? This week, former Giant Plaxico Burress pleaded guilty to a weapons charge and will serve 20 months in prison. He's already suffered the indignity of missing the playoffs because he had shot himself in the leg. Was a two-year prison sentence really necessary?
This got real serious real fast when the mayor and the district attorney both got involved with this, and I think Plaxico looked down the road and saw 7 to 10 and decided that 2 years was the best he was going to do. I am surprised that the authorities took this quite as seriously as they did, but they pretty plainly did.
On Thursday morning, the Texans and the Saints showed why it might be inadvisable for NFL teams to scrimmage against each other without referees present. The morning practice disintegrated into a fist fight, but Bob McNair, owner of the Texans, sounded pretty proud of his boys.
First of all, who would have guessed that Jeremy Shockey of the New Orleans Saints would be in the middle of a fight? I'm shocked. Shocked to learn this. But Bob McNair, who sets the bar rather low, apparently, for the Texans, said, "At least our players kept their helmets on, so that showed some intelligence." Well, yes.
The Washington Nationals are having a banner week. Not only did interim general manager Mike Rizzo manage to sign the team's first-round draft pick, Steven Strasburg, but the team also filled their vacant GM position with Mike Rizzo. I don't guess those two signings are related, do you?
I honestly believe that the Nationals went to him and said, "Sign this guy or you're fired." I really believe that. It's a good thing for the Nationals, who have not had many good things happen to them. Rizzo has said that Strasburg's probably not going to pitch in the major leagues this year. That's also a smart move, although the temptation to bring him up for one start at the end of the season may well be overwhelming.
Phillies pitcher Pedro Martinez got himself into trouble against the Diamondbacks on Tuesday. He left in the third inning and, after a rain delay, was replaced by the guy who Martinez had replaced in the starting rotation earlier this month. Any chance the Phillies have chosen the wrong guy to be a starter?
Jamie Moyer thinks so, and Jamie Moyer is the one who came in and threw in six innings of shutout ball, and they beat the Diamondbacks 5-1. These are two aging players fighting for playing time on a pretty good baseball team. Usually this is the kind of thing you see with teams who are 25 games out in the middle of July, but this is the defending world champions here with a couple of geezers pounding each other for playing time.
It's not often that we chat about high school baseball, Charlie, but when an
but when strippers are involved.
Exactly. When an Albuquerque public school coach is fired for hiring strippers to entertain his underage players, I think it probably bears mentioning. What could Stan McKeever possibly have been thinking?
Perhaps he was just trying to make sure his boys didn't go to the strip clubs, and the way to do that is to bring the strippers to the... I don't know. The guy's been in the school district for 23 years. He's also a math teacher. This isn't some 22-year-old guy who doesn't care about being a teacher. I have no idea what this guy is thinking. His team has won 5 state titles, though, so he's had a very successful career. So perhaps other coaches ought to take this approach to clinics around the country.
Oh, dear. Shaquille O'Neal's new reality TV show, Shaq Versus, sure is a fun idea, Charlie. And I understand that Shaq's former teammate, Phoenix Sun guard Steve Nash, thought it was a fun idea, too.
Yeah, apparently he had it first, according to the Arizona Republic, that Nash had told O'Neal about a plan to make a show which he competed against professional athletes of all stripes. Nash is now an executive producer. I think both men have found their roles. Nash is a very smart guy, would be a great executive producer. Shaq is a much better visual doing this stuff than Steve Nash would have been. Plus, Steve Nash might have actually been good at some of this stuff, and what fun would that be?
Memphis will vacate the 38 wins from its 2007-2008 Final Four season, Charlie, after the NCAA found the school guilty of several violations. Gee, I guess former Tigers head coach John Calipari got out of there just in time, didn't he?
What in the world is going on with basketball coaches in the state of Kentucky? We have Rick Pitino caught in the middle of a tawdry romance novel, and now we have John Calipari, who brought two teams to the Final Four, that both UMass and Memphis, that according to official NCAA histories now don't exist. They never went there. They both cheated. How is this guy still coaching, number one? I hate to say that, but you get two teams and it happens both places. You really got to think about it. I suspect that it's time for everyone in Kentucky to start rooting for Western Kentucky.
At the World Championships on Sunday, Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt took 0.11 seconds off his own world record time in the 100 meters. And then on Thursday, he bested his 200-meter world record by 0.11 seconds. The second-place finisher was 0.62 seconds behind, which is almost an eternity in the 200. Should runners not name Bolt just stop lacing up their cleats?
Well, he's so far ahead of the rest of the world right now. He's probably the most charismatic athlete in track and field. Times being what they are, I hope he's doing it in a way that won't set the drug police's hair on fire someday. But right now, there's nothing more compelling in all of sports than watching this guy run.
Charlie, my favorite tweet of the week comes from Lance Armstrong, who felt like going for a ride on a rainy day in Scotland, and he sent an invite out to his 1.7 million Twitter followers. I guess it's a good thing they didn't all show up.
It was funny, but 200 people did, and they rode with him in the Paisley District up in Glasgow. He was in town to watch you, too. And I think the coolest thing is that a former world champion named Graham Obrey actually showed up. And, you know, he was a champion back in 93 and 94. For all the problems people have with Lance Armstrong, this was a really nice thing to do.
I know how you enjoy Guinness Book of World Record entries, Charlie, especially when they have nothing to do with sports. But the story I turn over to you today has an added element of speed. So does that make it more to your liking?
Yeah, actually, it was 500 middle-aged and elderly people came to Shanghai University in the gym and dyed their hair. and they claimed a new record for the largest number of people dyeing their hair together in the same place. My favorite thing is that the record was witnessed and validated by China's record office and by the Shanghai Institute of Measurement and Testing Technology, most of whom probably never dreamed when they were in college that they would be doing something like this.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe magazine and is the author of Idiot America. He joins Only a Game each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org.
My love and me as we sing our early morning singing song.
Some of the best sailors in the world showed up earlier this month to race their Moth-class vessels on the Columbia River, marking the first time in more than 30 years that the International Moth World Championships were held in the U.S. The Speedy Moths hold only one person and appear to fly over the surface of the water once wind hits sail. Reporter Sadie Babbitts recently attended the Moth World and has this story on a little-known sailing discipline that's beginning to take off.
Out on the Columbia River, dozens of moth sailboats flutter across the water. This is one of 15 races at the Moth World Championships at Cascade Locks. In this race, sailors navigate a W pattern through the water. Roy McCormick of the Columbia River Racing Association keeps his motorboat at the far end of the course. He keeps his eyes trained on the dozens of boats zigzagging across the river in case he needs to rescue sailors whose boats capsized.
Here's Kevin Hall, 3457 from Australia, as well as Dalton Bergen, 3391 from the Seattle area.
They're neck and neck as they round a buoy and head back down the river. You could easily mistake them for windsurfers from a distance, but up close, it's clear Hall and Bergen aren't windsurfing. Their hulls are literally 3 feet out of the water.
It is an airplane that is on the water.
Bora Gulari has sailed moths for about 3 years.
There's two wings that ride underneath the water, and instead of having an engine, you have a sail. And that's basically it. I mean, it's literally an airplane. So I can't afford to have a real one, and this is the closest I can get.
The Detroit-based sailor is excited. Gulari just won the last race of the day, and he has a good chance of winning the world championships. He's still in his wetsuit as he brings the sail down and starts packing up for the day.
The very first time you lift off in a moth, you lift off, everything goes silent, all you hear is the wind.
You do lift off in a moth. The secret is two narrow pillars at each end of the boat called hydrofoils, which sport dolphin-like fins on the ends. When the wind catches the sail, the moth jumps out of the water and glides on those two fins. Gulari says these boats can sail at speeds upwards of 30 miles an hour.
This is one of the fastest boats in the world around a racetrack, and it's 11 feet long. If you weren't willing to sail one of these, and you wanted to sail on a big boat, you'd need like a 70-foot boat just to even keep a moth in sight.
It's no wonder moth sailing is gaining the reputation of being the Formula One of the water. Crashes and collisions are frequent, and they are always breaking down. Bill Symes is the president of the Columbia River Racing Association, which hosted the Moth Worlds.
I think the interesting thing is that it's this little unknown subculture, you know, the dinghy sailing world that most of the real world doesn't even realize exists.
It's a subculture that goes back to the 1920s, when this developmental sport was established. The 11-foot dinghies stayed in the water, and they were much slower than today's high-tech carbon fiber ones. Symes says about 5 years ago, people started experimenting with hydrofoils.
It's a development class. So, in other words, there's only three rules. It has to be 11 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and have 86 square feet of sail area. And within those parameters, you can do anything you want.
My name is Sean Couvreau, is my real name. My nickname, Doogie. I'm a professional sailor, and so I race big sailboats for a living. So I do events like the America's Cup, or Trans-Pacific, or Transatlantic races, or just daily circuit racing.
That's Couvreau's day job. He discovered moths on the internet and bought one a few years ago. Now he's paying his own way to race at the Moth Worlds.
The composition's unbelievable. The quality of this fleet is unsurpassed. I mean, you're beating, you know, there's gold medalists, Olympic champions, world champions, just all over the place. And, you know, there's 47, 50 boats or something, and all these guys are excellent sailors.
They've come from everywhere, from Europe and Australia, even Japan and the United Arab Emirates. Most of these moth racers are pro sailors. Most everyone here pays for the worlds out of their own pocket. It's expensive. The boat alone costs more than $17,000. And Couvreau says they're always breaking down, like Formula One race cars.
Well, a lot of us compare this like a little soapbox derby. I mean, you'll see there's toolboxes everywhere. You just kind of learn yourself and fix it yourself.
Yeah. Got some skill with it.
It's the last morning of the Moth Worlds. Everyone has their boat down on the beach, getting ready. Couvreau readies the control lines for his sail. By mid-morning, Couvreau and a fleet of 47 moth sailors are out on the Columbia River, sailing toward the start line. The racers get a 5-minute warning before the start. It takes that long to get the boats into position. They cluster around a committee boat where the winds are most favorable, and they wait. The moth racers lift out of the water and shoot over the start line, heading into the wind. On this last race of the world, sailors race the out and back course twice. Bora Gulari takes an early lead. He slides back and forth on his white tramp, ducking underneath the sail, adjusting it to the wind. He's flying.
3380. Then 3450.
After 25 minutes out on the course, Gulari crosses the finish line to become the first U.S. sailor in 33 years to win the Moth Worlds. To celebrate, he switches boats with a fellow competitor and takes it back out on the course to show off in front of his parents and a small crowd. Back on the shore, Gulari says he just focused on passing boats.
Got to sail my own race, and it seems like it's been the whole regatta. As soon as I get to sail my own race, it's just the boat wants to get to the front of the fleet. My boat is so fast. I think it's a person. It's fun. I don't know.
He sits on the shore with his best friend and training buddy, George Pete. A year ago, they both went to the Moth Worlds in England, and Pete says they struggled. Gulari is an amateur. He says he wouldn't be able to sail without his parents' support. His friend Pete is a professional sailor who's nearly speechless when I ask him what it means to have his best friend win the Moth Worlds.
We've been trying to win world championships ever since I met you 6 or 8 years ago. Means a lot. It's
pretty cool.
It's really cool. Every day you wake up and you want to win a world.
Yeah.
Did it today, man. Nailed it. You nailed it.
Bora Gulari won a large silver cup for the Moth Worlds and bragging rights. He's not sure where his next race will be. He's already trying to talk Pete into an international moth competition in Sydney, Australia in December. If that doesn't happen, Gulari will set his sights on defending his new title at the Moth Worlds in Dubai next year. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
And up you go! Look at me, way up high, suddenly, here am I, I'm flying. I'm flying.
Flying!
I can soar, I can weave, and what's more, I'm not even trying.
Wonderful!
High up and as light as I can be. I must be a sight lovely to see.
Only a Game is produced by Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Josh Levenshurz, who leaves us this week for a European adventure. Ciao, Josh. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Sadie Babbitt's moth sailing pictures or my Pan Mass Challenge photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from a moth racer who crashed the World Championship event in Oregon. Mothra was favored to win the event, but wouldn't you know it, Godzilla prevailed. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.